Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray, and today we're talking about Room 13 and Nightmare Stairs by Robert Swindells. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so as usual, check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Adam.
Hello.
It's good to be back. We haven't recorded in a little while.
No, it's been a month. My beard has grown long and haggard.
mine is still paltry, I'm afraid.
Not paltry. A chicken beard. the worst thing.
No, that sounds horrible. But we're back to talk about Room 13 and Nightmare Stairs a little bit. Mostly Room 13, I think, because it's more horror.
Okay. I will admit, I hadn't read Nightmare Stairs, and I had assumed that given the name, it would be a horror.
Nightmare Stairs.
It's called that because the character has a recurring nightmare about some stairs. So,
yeah.
To be fair, the stairs themselves aren't that nightmarish.
No.
Like, I was sort of expecting, you know, really kooky, slanted angle staircase. You know, maybe some steps bigger than others. Perhaps spiracular. Maybe painted an unusual colour. That's the kind of thing I wanted. But actually, it's Ordinary Stairs in a Nightmare, but that's not a very good book title.
Yeah. I hadn't read either of these.
Had you read any Robert Swindells?
No, I hadn't. I heard of them, but I hadn't read any. But I mentioned my podcast, as I do, to my D&D group a couple of weeks ago. I'm getting cooler by the minute.
In the middle of some climactic battery? Like, hang on, guys. Just check. You are listening to my podcast. No, we're fighting this dire wolf, Ren. Come on.
I will help you with this this battle if you'll promise that you're listening to my podcast.
If you answer me these questions free, have you listened to my podcast?
But one of them was said, oh, you should do that book about Dracula living in a hotel in Whitby. Shout out to Zoe. Because, yeah, here we are.
Well, as long as there isn't another book about Dracula living in a hotel in Whitby.
Yes.
I mean, I asked Pete, Pete hadn't read any either. I asked him and he said, oh, it sounds like a swindle. His propensity for puns, having put him off reading any of the guy's books, seemed a bit unfair to me. But So as a kid, I read a few Robert Swindells books. I read Brother in the Land, which was probably the first kind of post-apocalyptic book I'd read, and is very focused on the relationship between these two brothers and an older brother trying to look out for their younger brother while they slowly die of radiation poisoning. And having a younger brother, I guess, you know, I could sort of imagine this situation. I mean, it's kind of like a gender, not wholly gender flipped. Anyway, it's kind of a little bit like Grave of the Fireflies. Mm-hmm. In its relentless bleakness. It's not as pretty as lovable, perhaps. But anyway, that one really stayed with me. I found it quite harrowing. And I also read Stone Cold from 1993, which is a very disturbing book. For slightly older readers, I'd say, than the ones we're looking at.
Mm.
And it's a tale told from two perspectives. So one chapter is told from the perspective of a young homeless person, and then every other chapter is told from the perspective of a kind of vigilante or self-appointed vigilante serial killer who turns out to be murdering homeless people. And inevitably their two paths kind of horrifically collide. And it's a really nasty work, to be honest. I mean, it's describes experiences of being young and homeless, I think, very convincingly, and with a great deal of compassion. But it doesn't skimp out on the bleakness. It's a pretty rough time, that book. And probably kind of the darkest thing I really read as a kid. I mean, I did read all of it because it's not so much scary as just horrifying. It's very much rooted in reality. So it's just a really kind of grim and upsetting book. And I think it really stayed with me. I think perhaps one of the reasons, I tend to have quite a lot of homeless friends, and, I find it just all but impossible to just ignore people who are homeless or on the streets. And I do wonder if that book is somewhat the reason why, because it really brings home the potential vulnerabilities of being in that situation. So it's a very powerful book, and in a sense I'd recommend it, but it's really heavy going for a young audience, I'd say. I remember a couple of others, like Daz for Zoe and Inside the Worm.
I mean, compared to Room 13 is a bit of a lark, really.
Oh, yeah. No, it is. I mean, these are for a slightly younger audience and a bit more fun, really, than The Swindles I Dread. Which is possibly better for this podcast, really. I think I would struggle making jokes, to be honest, when talking about Stone Cold. So it really is quite bleak.
Yeah. Yeah, Room 13 is from 1989, which you can tell by the kids dancing to Madonna at the disco. And
I'm sure, also, no, the kids still dance to Madonna, don't they?
information not found. But also by the cavalier way in which teacher grabs a disobedient boy by his hair and sort of yanks him around.
I
feel like that might not fly these days. But then again, Swindles was a teacher, so maybe it was just wish fulfillment.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that, yeah.
It's also another installment in the theme of sinister things in British seaside hotels.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, we really are going all out on that theme.
Mm-hmm. It's good when we make the thematic collections of our podcast. That will be one strand.
Oh, you're right. That is what the cool kids do, isn't it? Like, Evolution of Horror, that's cool. Like, the folk horror and the zombie. So we'd have, Texture. I mean, that would be all of them. the hotel... the ones in which Adam and Ren make obscure 90s comedy references none of the listeners appreciate. That's, again, probably most of them. What else have we covered? Houses.
Houses. Yeah, weird houses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like nightmare stairs, although, again, not as weird as I'd hoped.
According to the dedication at the front of the book, Room 13 was inspired by a real school trip to Whitby by Year 2 from Mandale Middle School in Bradford, 1987. Which was a real school. It's now closed.
Do you know if it's a school Swindles worked at?
No, I couldn't find any more information.
Okay.
That would make sense, I guess, yeah.
I mean, it'd be quite odd if, like, it was just, like, a random school trip that, I don't know, he observed while staying in Whitby and was like, right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense if this was a school he worked at.
Yeah, so maybe it's his students he's dedicated the story to.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes more sense than me.
Well, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I thought, like, there was some mystery of, like, a middle school going to Whitby and meeting a vampire.
What? So you thought this book was definitely based on real events, basically?
Well, I thought that's what it was implying.
Oh, okay. I said, well, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, maybe that's all part of the rich fictional tapestry.
Hmm. Anyway.
Anyway, drawn from real events.
Yes. Whether they are a Dracula in a hotel room or just the experience of
Whitby.
Taking 13-year-olds to Whitby.
Yeah.
So our protagonist is Fliss, who is about 13 years old and going on a class trip away to Whitby. The night before she leaves, she has a foreboding and rhyming dream about her feet leading her against her will to a sinister house. And it says she goes past the gate of fate and the keep of sleep. And she goes over the threshold of room 13, which is the room of doom.
Really, really does feel like we're continuing this D&D theme.
Yeah.
That could be straight out of Nightmare on TV.
And in this room, she sees a shape in a box and smells damp earth, and the voice tells her she's seeing the bed of dread. Fliss is pretty freaked out, but when morning comes, she decides to get over her fear and go on the trip anyway. On the coach to Whitby, we meet Fliss's best friend, Lisa, Gary Bazzard, who's a loudmouth boy who starts talking about Dracula living in Whitby.
That's a great name. And
yeah, and Ellie May, who is a student that no one really likes very much. When the coach stops for a toilet break and Fliss's friend Lisa uncharacteristically breaks the rules and goes to the shop to buy a novelty torch in the shape of a dragon. When Fliss asks her why she did it, she says, "It's as though my feet were going by themselves." And this will be important later.
Yeah, the dark powers of consumerism.
So they arrive at the Crow's Nest Hotel in Whitby to find that it has the same image of the bird on the gate that Fliss saw in her dream.
Which also, rather neatly, do you have this in your Kindle edition, the chapter headings?
Yes.
Yeah, so the gate of the hotel forms each chapter heading, and you have the number, and then within the gate is a different picture, like representing what's going to happen in that chapter. And then for room 13, the chapter itself is wholly blank.
Yes, I mean, did you notice, was it wholly blank to you?
Well, oh my gosh, what?
Well.
Well, do I have to hold this up to the light, or like...
Yeah, well, mine was blank, so obviously it's an Unreal edition. Okay, but Zoe was saying that her edition, when she was a kid, had like, it looked blank at first, but it was like glow-in-the-dark...
What?
Glow-in-the-dark writing, saying something.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I've misplaced my copy. I can't do it right now.
Okay.
In fact, I was just trying to do it with my edition of Nightmare Stairs, which of course didn't work. although it did give me a sort of jolt of amazement, because opening up Nightmare Stairs, I turned to chapter 13 and obviously there was writing on the page and I was like, oh my god. Magical ink. But no, I mislaid it somewhere. Sorry.
That's fine. Can we break with tradition and do a very early texture of the week?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I've got a comb right here.
Brilliant.
Texture of the week.
Because I just talked about the gate, and my texture of the week is the gate. So
is a gate a texture?
Hey, hang on, Adam.
Okay, sorry.
Let me read.
Absolutely.
She came to a gate. It was made of iron, worked into curly patterns. Near the top was a bit that was supposed to be a bird in flight, a seagull perhaps. But the gate had been painted black, and the paint had run and hardened into little stalactites along the bird's wings, making it look like a bat.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
It's cute. Yeah.
A little paint like stalactites.
It. Yeah, it's nice. Yeah. well, mine was the stick of rock.
Oh, yes, of course.
I think, spoiler warning, but we already know this is a Dracula story, and I think this is foregrounded enough that, I mean, I kind of guessed where it was heading.
Yeah.
But is it Gary who has the rock?
Yes, I believe so.
Anyway, one of the boys buys this big stick of rock, and they kind of slip it into their trouser leg in order to hide it from the teachers and smuggle it back into their bedroom to kind of, you know, gnaw upon in bed, basically, because, you know, young boys are disgusting and sticky.
Yeah.
But throughout the book, his gnawing and licking sharpens the tip of the rock until it is usable as a stake, a candy cane stake to plunge into the heart of Dracula.
That's so good. I love it so much.
So I very much like the idea of plunging a big stick of rock into a body.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, like, presumably, I mean, it would shatter, but I don't know, presumably it's all shattered into the body, and all the glucose and the blood is all mixed together, and it's all sort of, sitting there, you've got this blood dripping down the candy, and then you're licking it all off and stuff.
Blood and peppermint and boy saliva.
Yeah, so all of that was my texture, great.
Yeah, wonderful.
It was like it was like the most illogical adventure game puzzle ever.
It's so good. I'm very, very into this. I've been just telling people about it. Like, I've just been reading this book where they stake Dracula with a sharpened piece of seaside rock. I love it.
Yeah, that was my favourite bit too.
I also did used to do that, but not stake Dracula, but I did used to suck pieces of rock until a very sharp point.
Oh, did you?
Yes, until they hurt my tongue.
Is that why you did it as a?
No, just enjoyed it.
Not a self-punishing. If it was me as a kid, that's probably why.
Yeah, I'm not you.
Who would have been Catholic guilt, you know?
No, but I had a thorough enjoyment of that whole idea.
Yeah.
And
I bet Dracula didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
You know, he spent all this time being like, right, I've got to be on the lookout for wooden stakes. But then, you know, boy comes in with a stick of rock. He's like, it's fine, it's a stick of rock. What's that going to do? And then something, oh my God, my heart! How did that possibly happen?
Yeah. I don't know if Are sticks of rock a particularly British thing? I don't. Maybe calling it rock is. I mean,
yeah,
it's just like a candy cane, but you don't. It doesn't have a hook for hanging on things.
Yeah, so yeah. It's a stick of candy, and often there's a word or a picture running all the way through it.
Oh yeah.
Like, I don't know.
Blackpool.
Blackpool running all the way through it. Yeah.
You know, because if our podcast statistics are correct, we have a number of international listeners.
We don't need to specify numbers, but it's a number.
Yeah, a number.
Are you sure this isn't the claim of the week?
I think this might be my claim of the week.
A number of international listeners.
A number of people not from our benighted island are listening to this podcast.
Or beleaguered island, as it very much is.
Yes.
Right, so, well, they've gone on the coach. Do you have any particular childhood coach memories? I mean, I was very travel sick as a kid, so.
Oh, well, yeah, me too.
Yeah, I hate
my particular coach memory is throwing up all over myself and all the other kids having to file off the coach past me with my skirt covered in sick. So.
That's all. Yeah, that's awful. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, coaches were never that fun, were they?
No. luckily we didn't get any vivid descriptions of coach sick in this book.
No, but you have now lovingly provided one for our listeners. Just in case you were worried of missing out.
Yeah.
So they get to the hotel.
When you get to the hotel, there's this ominous gate with its stalactites of paint. Fliss notices an unmarked room on her hallway.
And the teacher says, "Oh, it's just a linen closet, probably."
Yeah, it's just a cupboard or something. But that night, Fliss is lying awake when she hears a sort of whimpering, crying noise. And at first, she thinks it's from the next door room, but then she realizes it's coming from behind the unmarked door. And when she goes into the corridor to look at it, she sees the number 13 on the door that wasn't there before. The next day, the kids all go for a walk, and Ellie Mae drops behind, feeling sick and dizzy. Another boy, David Trotter, says that he saw her creeping about in the middle of the night, but Ellie Mae claims that she was asleep all night.
But he knows what pyjamas she was wearing, so... You know, Ellie Mae says, "Oh, you must have been creeping around, like, you know, looking at the girls in our bedroom." But it seems she might have been sleepwalking.
Mm-hmm.
As my brother used to do. I might have mentioned before, but yeah, he was amazing at sleepwalking as a kid. he'd sort of walk very fast up and down the landing upstairs in our house, and would sort of repeat things to himself like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And when he really got into gaming, you know, when he was sort of, I don't know, 8 or so, I remember he spent hours and hours playing Ocarina of Time, like first thing in the morning, go downstairs and turn on the N64 and just play it all day. And he actually must have been having this dream where he was in Ocarina of Time, because I honestly remember him, you know, in a sort of trance, like waving his arm about and saying, "I'll help you, Link. I'll help you, Link." Yeah. But he, you know, he says he doesn't really remember it, obviously. But yeah, it was quite a scary thing to witness, really. Have you ever slept walk?
No, I've never encountered it either. I've seen someone sleeping with their eyes open, and that was creepy enough to be honest.
Peter can do that.
Yeah.
That's pretty, yeah. I mean, Pete's one of the worst people to sleep next to in a bed, frankly. Like, it's really bad. Like, you know, he'll just wake up suddenly in the middle of the night. I think he must have some kind of problem with breathing when he's asleep, maybe.
Hmm.
Is it sleep apnea?
Yeah,
I do wonder if he suffers from that, because suddenly he'll just sit up really suddenly and go, like, sit up really straight. Really scary.
Yeah. Fliss starts to believe that Ellie Mae was in the cupboard at night, and gathers Lisa and Trot. It's a cool nickname, the David Trotter, and Gary to join her. So they meet on the landing at 11:30, and they all see the number 13 materialise on the door, which I thought I would just read the description of.
Sure.
As Gary whispered 0, they heard the town clock chime, then strike. At about the 4th stroke, they noticed a small shapeless mark on the door, and Lisa moved the torch slightly to get it in the centre of her beam. It was like a stain, lighter than the surrounding woodwork. As stroke followed stroke, the stain seemed to shrink and become paler, and then to divide, becoming two whitish blobs whose shapes altered, until by the 12th stroke, they formed the figures 1 and 3. As the echo died, they heard a door close somewhere below.
Hmm.
So, the number has formed on the door, and they see Ellie Mae sleepwalking, seemingly towards room 13. The four of them try to stop her, sort of physically restrain her, pin her to the floor, and she sort of still asleep, fights to get into the room. The teachers find them, but they end up deciding that Ellie Mae was sleepwalking and that the kids worried about her, so they don't get too badly punished. On their last day in Whitby, Fliss goes with Gary to the Dracula Experience, which is a sort of cheesy seaside sort of ghost train without the train kind of
well, sort of thing. Imagining it like the London Dungeons, but
yeah,
you know, much diddlier and cheaper.
A bargain at 50p.
God, that's great.
I mean, this was 1989, though.
Yeah, that's true.
It was one of those thick 50p's, you remember?
Yeah.
Mm.
Hamburgers were a penny then.
Fliss sort of panics when she's in this exhibit and tries to escape, but she ends up in a backstage area with Sal Hagerlife, who she'd seen outside the hotel at the bus stop, and people had said, "Oh, that's the mad woman." Sal tells her about the history of the crow's nest and its inhabitant. So the Dracula, who now occupies room 13, used to live in a gatehouse at Whitby Abbey, preying on unsuspecting tourists. But when the gatehouse was hit by shells in the First World War, he had to find a new place to live. He chooses the house that becomes the crow nest, where Sal was a chambermaid at the time. The young daughter of the house falls sick and starts wasting away, and the doctor thinks she's been walking in her sleep. But then when her family take her away, she recovers instantly. The house stands empty, sort of having this aura of creepiness about it, and occasionally someone tries to live in it but moves out soon. But then it becomes the hotel, and now Dracula has a coachload of visiting children each week to snack upon to his heart's desire. Sal somehow knows about Fliss's dream from the beginning of the story and tells her that she'll know what to do when the time comes. And sort of throughout the story, these four kids have been sort of finding or buying these little pieces, bits and pieces. So Lisa had the torch, Gary had the stick of rock, Fliss found a big heavy stone, and then
other boy
buys a cheap plastic kite that breaks almost instantly, and there's just this frame And then there's this sort of great coming together of the kids' various knickknacks into a vampire fighting kit, sort of in the style of Lord of the Rings, like, you have my axe and you have my bow sort of thing, except it's, you have the cross-shaped frame of my broken kite and my novelty dragon-shaped torch and my sticky piece of rock covered in bed fluff.
So, yeah, definitely more in the 90s point-and-click adventure game style.
Yeah. And so the next night they gather outside the hallway. When it becomes room 13, they break inside. Lisa shines the torch in his eyes. The Trot holds the cross-shaped kite frame out, and Gary brings the stick of rock to the vampire's chest, and Fliss hammers it in with her big flat stone. Let's read the description of Dracula when they find him.
Yeah, he's all gnarled and ratty.
Yeah, he is. He lay with his hands crossed on his breast and his eyes closed. He was thin and small and dirty. His face was dead white, except for a dark smudge on the forehead and a brown crust about the bluish lips. A fleece of pale, tangled hair, grey with dust, covered the skull, falling onto the bed of earth which covered the bottom of the coffin. His fingernails were split and blackened, and a disgusting smell rose from the single filthy garment he wore, which looked like a nightshirt or shroud. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good Nosferatu.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's sort of, you know, how you sort of picture the Murnau's silent film version, I think, or I kind of did.
Mm.
You know, all sort of sallow and spindly thing and withered and rat-like, yeah.
Dirt in the creases of his skin.
Mm, sort
of,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they struggle and they manage to drive this peppermint-smelling steak through his chest, and they spill out onto the hallway, and for the teachers run up the stairs and find that the room is just a cupboard once again.
And go, why you kids?
Yeah. The story ends on the bus back with Ellie Mae telling Felicity that she knows what they did for her, and that she's a witch. She finally...
I mean, how does she know?
Well, yeah. It's a good question.
But yeah, that she's finally free of Dracula and gonna be, you know, a nice, well-adjusted kid from now on who has friends.
Yeah.
And apparently their adventures continue. So really, instead of being led down the nightmare stairs by its misrepresentative title, we probably should have read Inside the Worm from 1994.
Oh, is that a sequel?
Which is a sequel.
Oops. Sorry.
So it set same school, same kids, and they dress up as a giant worm and seemingly end up being possessed by the spirit of the giant worm.
Oh my goodness. Okay, we'll have to come back to that.
Yeah, well, we do have another, because we haven't done the sequel to Intergalactic...
Interstellar Pig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was requested as well in one of our the emails we got.
Right, okay.
So maybe we could have a sequel...
sequel episode, yeah. That sounds good.
Because it sounds quite fun. So, yeah, did you enjoy this?
I did, yes. It was... yes, it was lively and full of slightly odd slang. my favourite example was someone saying, she's chuffed to little mint balls.
That is quite odd.
Yeah, to mean she's pleased. I mean, because that's what chuffed means. Yeah. I don't know what the little mint balls are there for, but yeah. I enjoyed that. It's it's set in the kids are from Bradford, so some sort of northern slang.
Yeah, I think all of Swindle's stuff. I mean, he was born in Bradford, so is he a Yorkshire man or Yorkshireman, as people say.
It didn't have a brass band in it, though. So
no, it didn't have a brass band. But yeah, I do think that he has. I don't know that there is something quite northern about his books, like
yeah,
and they're enjoyably no nonsense in a lot of ways. Like, I don't know. I kind of like the fact, like, I wouldn't go as far as saying that the girls who are protagonists in these two books, they're not mean exactly, but they're not super lovely or likeable either.
Yeah.
You know, they're quite snarky.
I guess it's interesting, yeah, we've chosen ones with a lot of main female characters.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But yeah, they remind me a little bit of Diana Wynne Jones's characters,
who are
also pretty no nonsense.
which I think works quite well when you've got kind of characters encountering supernatural events. Like,
yeah,
something quite enjoyable about characters being like, oh, this is annoying, oh, better get on with it, rather than just sort of being, you know, in a constant state of fear or astonishment. They do a good job. They defeat Dracula. That's pretty good. Like,
yeah.
Better than I would have managed at 13, that's for sure. I don't think I would have even dared go in the Dracula experience, let alone face the real Dracula. So, I've downloaded, I was trying to find a PDF of this book for the quotes, but instead I seem to have downloaded a teaching guide.
Okay.
To room 13. So, yeah, it's all formatted in Comic Sans, like all good teaching guides.
Yeah.
So we've got stuff about the national curriculum objectives, getting in the mood. You're saying that reading this book to pupils, you should probably adjust the lighting and add sound effects, which is what I sort of tried to do with the podcast, although lighting is something that you as a listener will have to adjust for yourself, really. So if you have a dimmer, use that. Or listen to our podcast while walking in the woods.
As sometime guest Alex is known to do.
But not while crossing the road, because you shouldn't listen to things while you cross. My mum, after I got hit by the car, you know, like a few weeks back, my mum keeps reminding me to, you know, take off my headphones when I'm crossing the road. So, saying that to all of you as well. Listen to cars. Oh gosh, that's ambitious. Hot seating activity. So you get the pupils to play one of the characters, and they have to answer questions. I don't know if you'd want to.
No. Yeah, go for it. Try me.
Okay. Which character do you want to be? Dracula.
I'll be Gary.
Okay, cool. Okay. All right, Gary.
All right.
How do you feel about Kirsty then?
She's in a different book, so I don't know her.
Very good. Trying to catch you out, Gary. That different plane of existence. Okay, how do you feel about Fliss?
Oh, I mean, she's a girl, isn't it? She's all right. Like, she came in the Dracula experience with me. I didn't think she would. You know, I thought she was too chicken. But I mean, she was too chicken. She ran away. But, you know, she's all right, I guess.
So you like the Dracula experience, Gary?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, it wasn't scary enough. Like, I mean, obviously I wouldn't be scared, but it, yeah, sure. You know, yeah. Like, you know, even the real Dracula wasn't that scary, you know?
Is that true, really? Like, the actual Dracula wasn't scary.
No, it was fine, you know? Like, yeah, we just got on with it.
So what did he do? How did he defeat Dracula?
Well, no, it was really cool, actually, like, because I had this stick of rock.
What?
And, like, it was this it's the biggest stick of rock that, like, anyone had ever seen.
What do you, so you mean, and, you mean like what, like a stalactite or like a bit of granite? Like
No, like rock that you eat, obviously. I had to hide it down my trouser leg from the teachers and no one knew I had
it. Don't tell me that, that's weird.
No.
So what, you've got this stick of rock, right? What did you do? Yeah, what do you do with that then?
Well, you know, I had it in my bed and I just, you know, because we had to stay awake to, you know, to find out what was happening. So I just sucked on this stick of rock for hours. It was great.
That's gross, but okay, yeah.
Yeah, and then it got like this really good point on it. Like it was really pointy.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it was really impressive. Yeah,
but how on earth did that help you defeat Dracula?
Well, like, obviously, you know, to defeat Dracula, you have to put a stake through his heart. Everyone knows that.
Yeah, but that's a stick of rock's not a stake, is it? It's a stick of rock.
Well, it's a pointy stick of rock.
Come on, that's a nonsense, Gary. You're telling me porky pies.
Excuse me. I'm the one who beat the actual Dracula, so I don't know who I'm even talking to.
And I have a podcast. But like,
yeah, I mean, I don't even know what that is. It's well, like 1989,
you're stuck in the 80s. Well, listening, do you like Madonna? You like Madonna, Gary?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, she's fit in it.
Come on. Come on, mate. Look, you get off my podcast, mate. You come on here, you tell lies about defeating Dracula with a stick of rock.
You know, bog off, Adam, bog off.
Can we come off, please, Ren?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, all right. Bye, Gary.
Well, yeah. I think that's why you don't have children on the podcast.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for that.
I've got
a list of spooky ideas. I don't really understand how they're ideas. So it's got loads of extra. It says spooky ideas in Comic Sans, and then it's got like half a dozen exclamation marks, and then lots of little clip art pictures of ghosts. And then it says haunted house, hotel, churchyard, hospital, old school, street, cathedral, cemetery, ghosts, friends, family, children, monsters, creatures, animals, well, poltergeist.
What?
Pretty spooky.
What are we doing with all these things?
I don't know. They're spooky. They're spooky ideas. Ooh, your family. Yeah. I guess you might sort of take them like, oh, what if it was your family and they were in hospital, and that they were dying, so they were going to end up in the churchyard. Ooh, pretty spooky.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
What about if there was a street, and on that street was some animals, and the animals ran a hotel, a hotel for monsters.
Oh,
pretty spooky. You can write a news report. I don't think we have time to do that.
Okay.
So yeah, that's. That's the lesson, really.
Nice.
I mean, I guess the kids kind of, you know, learn how to distinguish spooky things from not spooky things, which is a pretty important life skill.
It is, yeah. And one we're hoping to cultivate through this podcast.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, kids, if you're listening, kids, and your teacher says, why haven't you done your homework? You can say, I was actually educating myself as an autodidact through listening to Still Scared podcast. And I learned more than that. than I could from any book learning from you. Right? If you get in trouble, you know, that's on you, not us. Right, nightmare stairs.
Nightmare stairs. Okay.
So more of a thriller.
More of a thriller.
Yeah.
It's with some supernatural touches.
Yeah.
It's from 1997, so we're zipping forward almost a decade. With another 13-year-old girl protagonist, Kirsty Miller. It's kind of a reincarnation murder mystery.
Yeah.
So ever since Kirsty was a baby, she's had reoccurring dreams about falling downstairs. She knows details from the past and from her mum's past, and there's no way she could know these things, but she does. Do you want to read the description of the nightmare? It's on page 24.
Page 24. Okay, yeah. I'm in the dark at the top of the stairs. Steep, narrow stairs. I have to get myself down these stairs, but there's something wrong with my legs. They're stiff. It hurts me to walk. I'm standing there, sort of gathering myself to make the effort, when I see movement out of the corner of my eye. Somebody, or something, comes out of the spare bedroom, fast and quiet. I don't even have time to feel scared. Whoever or whatever it is puts a hand or paw in the middle of my back and shoves, and I topple forward, crashing down the stairs in a chaos of terror, shock and pain. I never hit the bottom. I wake up, damp and shaking. For a short time, I can actually feel the pain, hear the crashing round my falling body makes. I lie gasping, knowing that if I ever reach the foot of the stairs asleep, I'll never wake.
Mm-hmm.
Nightmare stairs!
Yeah, she sort of works out eventually. The reason that she knows these things is because she's the reincarnation of her grandmother. And the reason she dreams about falling downstairs is because that's how her grandma died. And that contrary to the family story, she didn't fall, she was pushed. So the story is kind of about Kirsty trying to work out who killed her former self. And the obvious candidate is her mean Aunt Anne.
Because she's mean.
She's such a meanie.
Which is basically Kirsty's only evidence. My aunt, sometimes, like, someone wants to get into a parking space and my aunt will deliberately take a really long time to vacate the parking space. So, QED, she's a murderer.
Yeah.
Well, I just thought she was a bit presumptive, to be honest.
Do you think, is this your claim of the week?
Yeah, okay. This
Kirsty.
Oh my god, what was that? Do some Mr. Bean voice. Claim of the week. I'm not above silly voices, Ren. Aunt, you're a murderer. Like, I don't have any evidence at all, but I've got this intuition, damn it.
Yeah. So she sort of sets out to scare Anne into confessing by kind of sending her creepy post.
Lots of threatening letters, basically.
Threatening letters, yeah. including, she's a very nostalgic trip down memory lane. She it doesn't mention it by name, but she uses Encarta, which was an encyclopedia CD-ROM that I used to do my primary school homework on.
Is that the one with the one with Mind Maze on it?
I don't know. Oh. It just had it was like an encyclopedia, but it was on your computer.
Yeah.
And she finds a photo of an Egyptian mummy, and prints that out and sends that to Anne with the caption "Mummy's back." Because yes, she's very pleased with it.
Yeah, she is. I quite like the fact that as a narrator, she kind of points out, like, "Yeah, this was really good. I was really pleased with this. I sent this one first." Because, you know, what's a threatening letter without a bad pun in it?
Yeah.
God, you know, if any of my family members are ever kidnapped, I'll be really disappointed if the letter they send doesn't have a pun or two.
I don't have terribly much to say about this.
No, I mean, look, it's quite zippy, which is the word you use to describe Room 13. It, you know, it paces along quite nicely. And it does have a twist in its tail. I don't know if we should reveal it or not.
Yeah, no, I think we should.
Okay, so...
So...
Do you want to say
it? Yeah, so it turns out that Anne was not the one who pushed her mother down the stairs. It was Kirsty's mother. So the mean, childless, career-driven woman is not, in fact, the murderer. It is the seemingly kind maternal figure.
And I quite like this as a kind of exploration of cognitive dissonance, I suppose, or I guess selective bias, because, you know, throughout most of the book, when she thinks it's her Aunt Anne, you know, she says, you know, she's a monster. She's a complete 100% a villain. You know, she should be locked away for life. She's absolutely evil. And then, you know, when it turns out to be her mum, she suddenly wants to make excuses for her and says, well, I still love her. And, you know, I'm sure she had her reasons. She's not bad, really. Which, yeah, I thought was quite, you know, perceptive. And I don't know how many kids would sort of pick up on that, but I thought that was quite a useful message, I guess.
True. she does a very quick turnabout in her thinking.
To
like, oh, well, she didn't, you know, she didn't mean to push her down the stairs, you know, she just... Yeah.
And of course,
it wasn't premeditated, she just snapped.
And of course, we've got the strange situation that she has been murdered by her own mother in a past life, who is also her daughter.
So,
back to the future, like, sort of scenario.
So... do you have any further thoughts about
not really. I mean, I say these two were a bit kind of lighter in tone than the ones I'd read as a kid, but they still do have this sense of dread to them that I think he's very good at building up a sense of dark things going on. And there's something kind of conspiratorial about the tone of these books. Like, you know, I guess they do tend towards thriller in as much as characters are often trying to work out what's happening and what's going on. I mean, they definitely kept me reading. Like, I never felt bored reading them. I think I quite like Swindles. And he's great at book titles. Like, he's released a lot, and I think if I could just read out some of the titles... It's almost like reading through the titles of a video nasties list, you know, because some of these titles are so kind of suggestive. So I'm just going to read out a few of them, because he has written a lot. But starting in the early 1970s, we have When Darkness Comes, Voyage to Valhalla, World Eater, The Thousand Eyes of Night, A Serpent's Tooth, Follow a Shadow, Unbeliever, The Last Bus, Smash, Abomination, Doodle Bug Alley, Wrecked, Blitzed, Branded, Snakebite, Burnout, The Tunnel, and A Skull in Shadows Lane.
That's good. Yeah, I'd definitely be happy to come back to some Swindles at some point.
Cool, same here.
Yeah. Do you have a sign-off? I'll do the credits and give you a moment to think. Our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music is by Joe Kelly. Artwork's by Letty Wilson. You can find details and links to their work, various kinds, in the show notes. You can Find us on Twitter at StillScaredPod or email us at StillScaredPodcast@gmail.com.
Adam. Yeah. Goodbye, spooky kids, and if you have a nightmare, don't get too stared. Like, nightmare stares.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
see you next time, spooky
kids. Is the pun I'm going to put in my threatening letter all right?
Till next time.
Bye.
Bye.